Station number 5190.
Lieutenant Colonel Luckin, Tape 2. You were telling me about what you did in the Palestine. Could you tell me about the road you drove up from Tiberias to the Syrian border?
Well, that would be roughly about the middle of 1920. The powers that be apparently decided then to station one unit at least much further north than the Sea of Galilee, and they picked on a place called Rosh Pinna, which would be probably about 15 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. It was rather a pimple in the middle of the Jordan Valley, and the first unit to go up there was the other famous Bengal Lancers. Now, that meant that we had got to construct a road of some description. There were tracks, of course, but a reasonable road right the way up from Tiberias across the north of the Sea of Galilee and away up to Rosh Pinna, and then a little bit beyond that. Now, I then shifted my headquarters, for what it was worth, from Sumac right up to Rosh Pinna. And the main job then was to organize some form of works on the road, and this was a real mixture because there was a Punjabi pioneer battalion working in one place. There was a half company of sappers and miners working somewhere else. We had one or two contractors breaking stones, and I also used to hire whole families of Arabs, etc., and so forth, to sit on the side of the road and break stones, etc., and so forth. But apart from the road, the main thing was to get a water supply to Rosh Pinna, and that entailed a lot of survey work. I eventually located a stream something like about, I suppose, 1,200 feet up the side of one of the mountains, which we tapped and laid on a 6-inch pipeline from there down into the camp, put up a big supply tank, and we'd got by that time a number of sectional huts coming up from various places. Now, gradually we got the whole of the people accommodated more or less on undercover. That was done in a variety of ways. I got done by these, you call them a local contractor, put up some of these huts and put them together. And I also employed a certain number of direct labour. And this came from the, I think they called it the Military Labour Bureau. They certainly paid them. And some were of a Palestinian origin, some were of Egyptian origin, and then they started bringing in the first of the people who I believe were coming into the country from the Zionist Commission. And if they were tradesmen, I sent a few of them. This scheme applied, of course, from all over Palestine, but I'd probably get about half a dozen, two of what might be carpenters, and the three said they were plumbers, and one said he was a bricklayer. The language difficulty was the greatest one because most of them were either Russian or Balkan in origin. And a certain number of girls came with them, and their idea was that they worked for a certain period. How much they were paid, I don't know, because I only had to certify that they worked and that they were tradesmen, and said that they were tradesmen and capable of carrying out the work. I also had to certify that the young ladies were virtuous, but that was rather beside the point. And if at the end of that time everything was satisfactory, they were given a sum of money and a kit of tools by the Zionist Commission, and they were free to leave and go wherever they liked. So that the whole of that period was a question of improvisation of almost every description. I mean, one had very, very little to work with at all. And of course, right out in the blue, at Rosh Pina, our only means of communication with the remainder of Palestine was with the field wireless apparatus, etc. and so forth. And I remained up there until, I think, somewhere like about January 1921, it might have been a bit later than that, and the Commander Royal Engineers then had decided that I'd had my fair share of the rough of it, and he transferred me down to Haifa, and I was replaced by another staff sergeant, just to give us a break. And my wife and family came out from England in May 1921, and we remained in Haifa, where we built a new hutted hospital and all sorts of RE works of every description there, general maintenance, etc. Until April 1922, when I was transferred from Palestine down to the Egyptian command, to a place called Sidi Bish, just outside Alexandria, for about 10 miles outside of Alexandria, where I remained until the end, Christmas 1924.
And there you
reverted to the home establishment.
You were automatically promoted while you were in Alexandria, weren't you?
No. Now, we used to have to do 6 years from Staff Sergeant to QMS. Well, my 6 years was not up. You see, I'd been May 1919. My 6 years was up in May 1925. And I had come home and I was in deep cut in the Aldershot Command, somewhere around about February 1925.
And it was in Sidi Bish that you encountered the Russian refugees?
Yes. That's right. When I first went there, there was something like about a camp of about 200 or so, stuck right out into one of the very old camps dating back to the 1418 war. And I think quite genuine. They were all emigres of the real old Russian aristocracy, dukes and duchesses and princes and princesses and one thing and another. I don't think there was anybody of any plebeian, very low rank at all. And they were fed, presumably by the Zionists, by the League of Nations, I don't know. But I employed them, because every night there when the sun went down, you got a very strong wind swept in from the sea, and it used to deposit something like about 6 inches, or sometimes very bad, as much as 2 foot of very fine sand over all the roads, and they used to have to turn out every morning with their brooms and shovels, etc. and so forth, and clean something like about, between them, some 3 or 4 miles of road. But I should think somewhere around about June or July 1922, the League of Nations moved the whole lot of them and shot them away up into the Balkans somewhere, and that was the last I saw of them.
Yes. So in 1925, you went back to Aldershot, and then you went to Didcot, didn't you?
Deep Cut. Not Didcot.
Oh, I see.
Deep Cut.
And what was your rank when you...
Well, when I first got there, my rank was that of a Star Sergeant. But all being well, my 6 years as a Staff Sergeant would be up in May, and I would be due for promotion to QMS. There, we must go back a little bit, because in 1914 they stopped the foreman of work classes, and they didn't start them up again until 1918, when somebody realised that if and when the war finished, they would have no clerk of works coming forward. And so they started up this class again, and I was fortunate enough to get on there. Now, it was obvious there was going to be a 4 years gap there. And under the old regulations, that having got promotion to QMS, when you had been a QMS for 3 years, you could sit for a special examination for promotion to Clerk of Works, Warrant Officer Class 1. And if you passed, and provided you didn't go over the age limit in the meantime, you had a reasonable chance of getting WO1. Now, that had swayed me. It's that persuaded me to make a service career because of that 4 years gap. And then in 1925, the War Office woke up to the fact, you see, that unless something was done, they would not have any people qualified for promotion to WO Class 1. An army order was issued stating that they would hold one special examination for that year only in September, and that any quartermaster sergeant, clerk of works, could sit for it, irrespective of how long service he'd got in his particular rank. I immediately went to my own commander, Royal Engineer, and said, look, sir, now, this has come out now, and it's now April. I'm hoping that next month, provided you agree, I should be promoted WO2. But am I eligible to sit for this examination? Because they want this return sent in now. I am not a QMS, I'm still Staff Sergeant, but I will be a QMS long before the examination. Said, I don't know, but I'll find out, which he did, and they came back and said, yes, that I could sit. So I sat for that examination and then dismissed it from my mind, and very much to my surprise, approximately just over 12 months later, I found that I had been promoted to WO Class 1, apparently about the only person that had been bright enough to sit for this examination, which let me in very nicely, and I had made, I think, a record for the Royal Engineers in that I was a Warrant Officer Class 1 with 13 years service in, which was really great going in those days to have done that.
In 1929, you became a Lieutenant Surveyor of Works.
Yes.
That was your next promotion, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, then in 1926, the War Office decided to do away with what they used to call the old staff for our services, which were directly enlisted commissioned officers of the quantity of battles, etc., and throw it open to their own foremen of works and clerks of works, provided that we could sit and pass the examinations of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors. Well, I'd got rather involved in examinations just at that time, so I went ahead and said, all right, I'd have a go at this as well. And I passed my intermediate examination in 1937. 1928, and I was duly commissioned as a Lieutenant Surveyor of Works in May 1929.
Then in 1931, where did you go?
In 1929, I came here to Salisbury Plain as Surveyor of Works with the CRE Salisbury Plain. That was a bit of a misnomer because it spread all the way from Bristol, right away up to Didcot, etc., and so forth. And at the end of 1930, for reasons best known to themselves, I was moved from there to Edinburgh, to the CRE Lowlands, which covered the whole lowland area of Scotland. And I remained there until October 1934, when I embarked on the SS Somersetshire and wandered out to Hong Kong, arriving there just before Christmas, 1934.
So, you weren't surprised to be stationed in Hong Kong, were you? You'd missed an earlier posting to the Mauritius, I think.
Well, you passed a remark that I seem to have had a long period at home. Well, that was so, you see, because having qualified as a WO1, and then I had put my name down to sit or to try for this Savara Works Commission, that I really was due to go to Mauritius. But I was promptly taken off the Foreign Service roster in order to enable me to sit those examinations. Having passed them and been commissioned, of course, then everything in the previous service, in a sense, was a washout, and I now started again. Yes. As an officer, it's a different kettle of fish completely.
What sort of ship did you go to Hong Kong?
An ordinary troop ship, the old SS Somersetshire.
And where did you disembark?
In Hong Kong itself, in the Hong Kong harbour. There's no other.
Before you arrived, were you issued with any equipment at all?
No. Now, as an officer, of course, you had to provide all your own uniforms and your own equipment. The only thing issue that we got was a revolver, a compass, and a pair of binoculars. You got a grant, money grant, which was supposed to enable you to buy your uniform, but it didn't come anywhere near it.
How much was that?
I think, if I remember right, we got about £80 altogether. But of course it cost you something like about £40 for your mess kit alone. Then you've got all your other equipment, sand brand belts and swords, service dress shirts, and every immortal thing. You had to buy it all yourself.
I think you mentioned that, in fact, you were better off as a WO1 than you were...
Yes, actually, there wouldn't be a great deal in it, but as a WO1, of course, one was then, before what they call the equalisation of pay, that the Corps of Royal Engineers was the highest paid corps in the army, and on the Staff for Engineer Services, that's the specialist of which I was one, we had an even higher rate of pay than the corps itself. So I think a warrant officer class one in the days I'm talking about, roughly 1926, was 12 shillings a day. And a WO class one clerk works for 16 bob a day, which is a very big difference in them. Plus the fact, of course, you had free quarters, light, etc., and so forth. Certain amount of rations and a certain amount of ration allowance and so on, which was all more or less free, and fuel, light, everything. And you got commissioned, you got 19 bob a day, but apart from getting a what they called a quarter and ration allowance, if there was no quarters available for you, that was your lot, and you've got to manage this way you could. It much balanced itself out, I think.
What was the quarter allowance? Was
that? To be quite frank, I can't remember.
Did your family come with you?
Not to Hong Kong, not immediately to Hong Kong, because when I was ordered out there in 1934, my son was then 17 and our daughter 15. It was essential that my son finished his schooling, and he was then at the George Heriot School in Edinburgh, and we had got plans for him, and that was all lined up for him to go as an, call it an apprentice, if you like, with the Automatic Telephone Engine Company in Liverpool when he was 18, and so had no alternative but to ask for a deferred passage for my wife and daughter, and I had to go ahead on my own, leaving them down then. When he'd done his, finished his schooling and gone to Liverpool, they joined me out there roughly some 18 months later.
What were your first impressions of Hong Kong?
Well, I don't know. It's very difficult to make an idea of first impressions. Probably was the crowded state of the place. Although, I suppose by modern standards, what we read, it was comparatively uninhabited then. But it was extremely crowded, extremely colourful, very varied in scenery. You had almost every type of ship in there, from Noah's Arks to the very latest modern liners coming in there, discharging passengers and tourist vessels, etc. and so forth. But the whole place struck me that it was always on the move, always a bustle the whole of the time. I mean, the harbour was always alive with shipping, and mainly in junks and sampans by the hundreds and even thousands, etc.
Was the presence of the British garrison very obvious?
No, because there had been a scare up north when the chaps and they invaded Manchuria, and I think about 1932, and they had strengthened the garrison up north. But that had quietened down and they'd been withdrawn, so that the garrison, as near as I can remember, in 1934, I think were two infantry battalions, one of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, the other one was the Seaforth Highlanders. There was an Indian battalion, I think it was the Rajput Rifles. There was a fortress company, Royal Engineers, there, because they manned the searchlights, etc. and so forth. The actual defences of Hong Kong from the artillery point of view were fairly meagre, but they were manned by a very peculiar unit known as the Singapore and Hong Kong Royal Garrison Artillery, and they were all Indian with British officers. So it was a bit of a mix-up there altogether.
Yes. And were you all stationed together?
No. Well, there was one battalion was stationed on Hong Kong Island itself, the Indian battalion, and one British battalion was over on the Kowloon mainland, one in a camp called Sham Shui Po, and the other one out at Castle Peak. The fortress company was stationed in Victoria Barracks at Hong Kong itself.
And where were the, was it the Hong Kong and Singapore volunteers, was it?
No, they called them the Royal Garrison Artillery. Singapore, yeah. And Hong Kong Royal Garrison Artillery.
Where were they stationed?
Well, they were mainly in a small barracks known as Gun Hill, and that was over on the Kowloon side. But they were not a very big unit for the simple reason there were very few guns there. I mean, nobody had ever thought of really defending Hong Kong. It was only just about that time that one began to wake up to the fact that Hong Kong was more or less defenceless, apart from the Navy point of view. The Navy, you see, has provided the bulk of the horses there. The depot ship was the HMS Tamar. Then you had the aircraft carrier, the Hermes. She was always there with probably about two or three cruisers. And then you had the fourth submarine flotilla that was based in Hong Kong. This has suited me. I knew them. I knew all the relief crews, because they went out on the Somersetshire with me. So I got to know them all very well, and I did quite a number of submariner trips with them on the anti-piracy patrols and so on. There were quite a lot of piracy went along on the China coast there, around Bias Bay and so on.
Can you tell me something about these anti-piracy patrols?
Well, they was done, you might say, as a routine training business. There were a certain number of gunboats there, I forget the names of them now, which were quite light craft, just armed with 12-pounders, etc., and so forth. And they used to scout out around the coasts and in and out of all these little bays, etc., and so forth, looking for the Chinese pirates who never preyed on the big ships at all. They intercept the trading junks coming down, you know, and raid them. And, well, it was just a question if they could catch them, all well and good.
How long did these patrols last? Were they sort of several days?
Oh, yes, they'd go in for 3 or 4 days. And then with the submarines, of course, there it was mainly a training exercise as far as they were concerned, because there's very little a submarine could do, except if the only trick that they had was if they spotted one which were absolutely certain that it was engaged in piracy of some sort, was to very, very gently come up on underneath her and tip her over, and then just leave it at that. So they never engaged in gunfire or anything like that, wouldn't they? It's too hazy altogether.
So they didn't take pirates prisoners or anything like that?
No, not unless they could catch them. Yeah. Absolutely red-handed.
And you just went along for the ride?
Oh, I only went along for the ride. I used to know these fellows. I had an opportunity to go along to try anything once. So I'm not very interested in the experience.
What sort of submarines were they?
Now you've got me. I don't know exactly what how you would describe them there, but I don't even know what the tonnage would be. I can remember nearly all their names, because they were all O-boats. There was the Otis, and the Otway, the Odin, the Oswald, the Osprey. I can't remember the other one. The mothership was the Medway, I know.
And what sort of other things did the submarines do apart from anti-piracy?
Well, there, you see, I'm no authority on naval matters at all. I mean, they would simply do their own training.